Welcome to the Soldier for Life podcast, where we share information and resources for our military and veteran families, from employment and education to health and wellness and Army retirement. We're here to help you learn more about programs and resources that are available to our Army family. The information shared in this podcast does not constitute an endorsement by Soldier for Life, United States Army, or the Department of Defense. And now, let's get started with this week's episode.
Thank you for joining us today on the Soldier for Life podcast. I'm Colonel Jared Thomas, the director of the Soldier for Life program and the host for the Soldier for Life podcast. We have an important episode for you today, one that everyone out there needs to hear. September is Suicide Prevention Month, and today we will be talking to you about the topics of suicide and mental health with someone who has struggled with both. It's a hard topic, and unfortunately one that many have had personal experience with, but it is a discussion that is critically important for us to have. Before we begin, if you or someone you know is struggling, the Veterans Crisis Line provides 24/7 free and confidential support for veterans, service members, and their families in distress, as well as prevention and crisis resources for you or your loved ones. If you need help, please reach out by dialing 988 and pressing 1, texting 838-255, or chatting online with www.veteranscrisisline.net. Our guest today is David Woods Bartley, a mental health advocate and motivational speaker. Today, we will get the opportunity to listen to David's story and learn about his journey from mental illness to mental wellness. David, thank you so much for spending time with us today and sharing your story.
Sir, I have been looking forward to this. I couldn't wait for the moment. So, but actually, let me kind of direct that back to you. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here with you and to talk about this. As you said so eloquently, sir, it's such an important and critical topic, not just in September, the 11 other months of the year as well.
I think for the listeners out there, this is going to be a very, very important topic for us to hear. And I've had a chance to hear you speak before and learned a great deal. And I expect our listeners will learn a lot as well. So if you could you tell us about your background and your life growing up? And what is your connection with the military?
So happy to say, I'm the youngest of four boys. And sir, I adore my three older brothers, John, Jim, and Tom. They are 6, 9, and 11 years older than I. So, and of course, I was the favorite. I mean, you know, you saved the best for last, obviously.
Of course.
So I was born in January of 1963 in the Midwest. And then 3 years later, I don't remember, but we did ultimately move to the suburbs of Washington, D.C. And that's where I was raised. But unfortunately, we suffered the loss of our father, James Hamilton Bartley. And he served, was just 42 years old, and he had made the unfortunate choice of being a smoker back in the 60s. And so it was not only, though, sir, lung cancer that took his life. From what my brothers shared with me, he was also debilitated, albeit crippled, by devastating depression. And interesting to note, probably important to note, his father, my grandfather, who I never met, had killed himself. And so at one point, this genetic influence would impact me, but my mom remarried. My beloved bonus dad, Richard, had 9 children. So, sir, believe it or not, I had my own little brigade in our house. I grew up as number 12 of 13.
Wow.
And had a very kind of normal, up to a certain point, growing up, great friends and things like that. But ultimately, life took an interesting turn. But in those challenges, who has always been ever present, and this to answer your question about what is my love for the military come, because unfortunately I've never served, but at the time that my father died, I realized now that my eldest brother, John, he stepped in to be my dad. And and as you and I were talking a little before the podcast, he continues to be that presence in my life. And my beloved brother, he enlisted in 1970 as a loader on an M60 tank ultimately made his way to West Point, graduated in 76, and that was the famed class of the last all-male class of West Point. And then Sir ultimately would serve 42 years and pin on two stars as an 08. And I've lived on post with him, and he continues to guide me. And so the work that I do now in standing next to you and all the others who are committed to ending soldier suicide, I feel like I honor my brother. I really feel like I honor my dad.
That really brings this all together in why not only is this important for you as a mission for you, you know, the mental health piece, but also the preventing suicide piece, but then also the connection to the military. Like I said earlier, I had an opportunity to kind of hear your story in the past, and you mentioned a date, August 31st, 2011. And that's kind of where your story starts when we talk about this. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah. And that, sir, is the date that I tried to kill myself. And that was the date that, and I call this thing, and I think you would agree with me, the monster of suicide and its sibling crippling depression like my beloved father had. Sir, it convinced me of a whole slate of awful lies. And it's an important distinction that it's not what I was thinking. And it's not even what I was feeling, it's what I believed. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we don't often talk about when we talk about this aspect of suicide prevention is I think we need to understand that people like me are being moved forward to horrific places because of beliefs. And what I believed, it made no sense that I was useless and stupid and pitiful and grotesque and absolutely ugly and hideous. And probably the worst belief was that I believed that if I killed myself, everybody would be better off without me. Mm-hmm. And so at the time, I was living with my former bride, Deanna, who thankfully I'm still great friends with. And we lived in Northern California, where I still do. And Dee and I live, sir, on this beautiful, perfectly rectangular 2.5-acre piece of property. And I loved this property. And I remember waking up on that morning, I took a final walk around the property. And then I had a fire engine red Dodge Dakota pickup truck. And I made a short 20-minute drive from where Dee and I lived to what's known as the Forest Hill Bridge. Now, we lived only 2 hours away from, of course, the famous Golden Gate Bridge. Most people don't know the Forest Hill Bridge, but it's 730 feet tall. It's 500 feet further off the ground than its more famous cousin. And important to note, sir, that this was not the first time I made that drive. Mm-hmm. And for most all of us who suffer, suicide is almost never spontaneous. So I parked my vehicle, put the keys on the dash, walked to the midpoint of the bridge, pressed my body up against the barrier, which hit me right across the top of my chest, and then didn't look out, instead looked down at the North Fork of the American River. And at that moment, time, as you and I know it, it stopped. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that because I don't know, sir, how long I was in that position. But I was conscious of what was going on. I felt the breeze from the river. I felt the sun in the back of my neck. I felt the bridge bounce as cars went by. But somebody saw me, thank God. And they called then 911, and a sheriff's deputy approached me from the left-hand side. And as I'm passionate to say, he made no contact with me at all. He created connection. And sir, my ardent belief is that connection creates this thing called hope. And hope, above all other things, saves lives. And I was taken off the bridge to an emergency room, and now I'm going to go do 15 days in a psych ward, a loony bin, a nut house. But you know what? My 15 days there changed my life. It was the genesis of this journey that continues up and down and up and down and up and down from mental healthness to mental wellness. But when people, sir, found out where I was and why, they couldn't believe it. They're like, what? David? David? David, the smiley guy? The happy guy? David, who was married to Deanna, who ran a nationally recognized end-of-life animal sanctuary. You can't be talking about that, David. Mm-hmm. And we did this incredible work, sir. We ran a sanctuary called A Chance for Bliss. We had as many as 100 animals at any one time, and it was an immaculate. It was this extraordinary place. And so people saw me taking care of dying animals with my former beloved. smiling, happy, picking up manure, doing all these things. Like, how could that guy be the guy that's like one heavy thought away from killing himself? That can't be. But unfortunately, we who suffer, we who have arrived at that place, for me, a dark spot on a tall, tall bridge, that place driven by dark beliefs, we can fool you. Because what we also believe is, you don't want to hear about my troubles. This is unsolvable. There's nothing anybody can do. I'm not worthy of your attention. With all of these things, we can be right in front of you and you not know. But my life has changed by that single initiation by that extraordinary officer. And I'll share with you what he did to allow me to have this presence here 13 years later. 13 years of life, sir, I never thought I'd have. All of those days, additional days, and the days that are going to be in the future.
And I like when you talk about the importance of connection and how connection leads to hope and hope saves lives. And I think you're getting ready to get into this. What happened after that pivotal life-changing moment when the officer connected with you on the bridge that day?
Well, it was really, and I think it's important, sir, if I can, I'm going to step just a little step before that. The connection was based on the first question that he asked me. And I literally yesterday was training a group of police officers. And I said, the first question that this amazing soul asked me was, would you please share with me how you are feeling? And it's just like, and I remember being stunned by that. And then that led to a conversation that led to me, which, and this is the heart, I believe, of connection, of feeling seen, heard, and valued, then ultimately went to this psychiatric facility. And I remember on the ride over, I was incredibly stressed, but I think that life can put you into the presence, sir, of people that just somehow know at a certain moment, they know the exact and right and perfect simple thing to do. And I remember the EMT in the back of the ambulance sensing my stress. He was a big man, and his hand was like a bear claw. And he put it, sir, right on my heart. And he looked at me and he said, "Hey, brother, I can only imagine how you feel. I don't know, but I have an inclination. Please hear me when I say you're going to a good place. And I just know in my heart you're going to be okay." And 13 years later, yes. And in between, of course, and there's been lots of therapy and medication and all of these different things. But without those initial steps, which I think, sir, are so essential, and I worry that we as a society don't realize how much power, how much life-saving power we have right in our hands that we can deploy immediately in every situation that we come into. No matter where we are, who we are with, and I'll give you examples whenever it's appropriate, but I know this works.
You know, and that's important to hear, I think, especially for our listeners, because I think, you know, we may be out there, you may see or think, you know, someone is going through something, but you may feel personally that, hey, I'm not a subject matter expert. I'm not I haven't been school trained. What if I say the wrong thing? But listening to you makes me believe that, you know, saying something is more important than doubting your ability to change someone's direction at that particular time, especially if you see that something doesn't seem right. You know, so the connection piece, just talking to somebody, if you see something that doesn't seem, you know, normal or something seems out of place, just speak up and say something, and you may be able to impact someone's life in a positive way just by having that connection that you talked about.
Sir, you are 1,000% correct. And my brother, being my brother, who's my dad, has always said, has said, "Hey, man, you can't just throw a term out and not like anchor it." So for me, it's either definitions or quote. Right. So I use Brené Brown to define connection, in which the great Dr. Brown says, "I define connection as the energy that exists between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued, when they can give and receive without judgment, and they derive strength and sustenance from the relationship. And we're like, that's like, okay, mic drop. Like, so, and my assertion, sir, is that in that space, you're only going to experience one single emotion, and that's hope.
Right.
When you, what, just all of that. And so then you say, okay, all right, though, David, what's hope? Cambridge Dictionary, the feeling that what is wanted can be had. So I say, the feeling that what is wanted can be had. That's hope. So you think, I come to you, sir, we're connected. Mm-hmm. Every time I'm with Colonel Thomas, I feel better. Every time I'm with Colonel Thomas, I feel like this, what this thing that I want, be it an end to my pain, a feeling of inclusion, whatever it is, I feel like every time I'm with Colonel Thomas, I feel like I can have that. So I'm having the experience of hope. I would go so far as to say that when any of us who have experienced any aspect of suicide, when we are feeling hopeful, we're safe. We're not going to take our life when we feel hopeful. We won't. Not in that moment. We won't. And the thing is, hope, and I have a quote right here, sir, because I gave a talk this morning, and this is Jane Goodall, because I worry that people say, David, oh, okay, that's kind of cute, cute and cuddly hope. Oh, yeah. No. Hope's a weapon. Mm-hmm. It's like what my brother loaded on that M60 all those years ago. And this Jane Goodall says this, hope is often misunderstood. People tend to think it is simply passive wishful thinking. I hope something will happen, but I'm not going to do anything about it. This is indeed the opposite of real hope, which requires action and engagement. So, and that's the clarity of that is so beautiful, sir, in my mind, because what this tells me is I can create it. I was with a group of behavioral health workers this morning, and I said, that's not your title. Your title is you create hope, because in all the work that you do in county services, you create the experience of dealing with people like me where we feel seen, heard, and valued because you're master connectors. That's what you do. And so I think, sir, to your point, I share three different ways that we can create connection anytime, anyplace, anywhere, because we have no idea. The truth is we have no idea who's suffering and who's not. So let's just say, you know what? I'm going to just throw this connection out everywhere and catch the person I hope who either needs to make a good day great or a bad day doable.
Are you still seeing stigma about seeking mental health assistance or a tendency by some to hide or ignore their mental health struggles?
You know, I think yes. And I would say it's lessening. Over the years that I'm doing this work, it's definitely lessening. I think it's my brothers. I'm 61 years old. It's my brothers out there in this age group, sir. I think we're the ones that still are the most resistant. I think the younger generation, I sound like I'm a grandfather, the younger generation they are more willing to embrace and say, hey, you know what? I need help. So, but I do see that things are getting better. And I think a lot of it is because of programs like this.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you see, just like you said, you see it more often in younger generations. I'm a father of a 25-year-old and a 21-year-old. They speak about, you know, mental health and mental issues more freely than I think, you know, me as a 51-year-old, you know, tend to do. So I think you're right. I would agree. I think we're definitely making progress in that. And I believe everyone, you know, in the military and veteran communities needs to continue to work to break the silence and end the perceived stigma that surrounds this topic of mental health, especially, like you said, in those that are in advanced age as opposed to some of the younger generation as well. But we are making progress, I think, and I'm glad to hear in your line of work that you're actually seeing that as well.
No, very much so, sir. And I think, you know, one of the things that I talk about in making connection, there's three things. It's recognition, it's understanding, and it's expression. I think one of the ways that we can continue to facilitate and initiate connection in the understanding piece, it's all about how we ask the question. I'm passionate now, and have been for a while, to ask people to make a commitment to me to never for the rest of their life ask a why question. Because why questions, if you think about it, every time somebody asks us a why question, what do we have to do? We have to justify ourselves. You have to justify. That's mm-hmm. what why requires. However, when you ask a what question, what you actually have the opportunity to do is to share. And that's totally different. We have a situation we see, say, why did you do that? As opposed to, what inspired you to do that?
Right.
What was behind you motivation to do that? It's a totally different question. And I think, sir, going back all the way to what you so beautifully talked about, is that we can initiate conversation. We see somebody, and maybe as my mom, my beloved mother Suzanne used to say, she said, David, always follow your gut feeling. We say, man, something seems off. I don't know what it is. And just say, hey, it's how you initiate the conversation. It's what the officer did to me, for me, with me on the bridge. And he said, would you please share with me how you are feeling? Now, and like, what an incredible question to ask somebody who is in the throes of a suicidal situation. It's very counterintuitive. You think, hey, I don't want to talk about how he's feeling right now because that's just going to exacerbate the situation. But think about what Maya Angelou said. There's no greater agony than bearing the weight of an untold story. So you realize the genius of that, and thus the question from the officer, which of course proved to be true, was actually allowing he allowed my soul to breathe. If he had asked me a why question, hey man, why are you doing this? Why today? Not a chance. I'm convinced I wouldn't be here.
Now, it's a great point. Asking, you know, the right question can make a huge difference. And I know you talked about this earlier, and you've done a great job explaining that day, but how did you turn yourself around? And, you know, even though you experienced this, how did that lead you to become a mental health advocate?
It's a great question. I laugh because I live in a place called Placer County, and they do an amazing job of mental health services. And I've touched all parts of county services. And so at one point, somebody said to me, hey, you should be part of the Speakers Bureau. And I'm like, well, what is that? I said, well, you know, you go and you speak. And I'm like, well, what do you talk about? He said, well, you would talk about, you know, you would tell your story. And I'm like, what story? Well, your story with mental illness. And I'm like, good gracious. And I asked a why question back then. I said, why would you do that? And sir, they said, well, we'll pay you $100. I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And sir, that, I'll be honest, that was my motivation mm-hmm. at the time. So that led to, you know, one thing and another thing and another thing. And I am surrounded by extraordinary human beings in not just my inner circle, sir, but in like concentric circles that go out. And the therapists and the psychiatrists and all these different souls who have helped me, you know, I can say thank you, which is helpful. But if I can talk about what they have done for me and share that with somebody else, maybe that changes their mind about being willing to go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist or sit in a support group or take medication. Or most recently for me, because depression came back at the end of last year, sir, and just about literally killed me again, I now have been taking part of what they call ECT or electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy. And it has changed my life. So that's now another passion that I have, because the efficacy of that is somewhere between 60 and 90%. But people don't want to do it because they're thinking, wait a second, they're going to cause you to have a seizure? Like people who have epilepsy, and that somehow is going to be helpful? And I'm like, yes, that's actually it. Because your brain gets flooded, my brain, 34 mm-hmm. times as of tomorrow, it'd be flooded with neurotransmitters. And over the course of this treatment, under the care of an extraordinary group of mental health professionals, it's like rewired my brain. And I have seen changes in myself that, in addition to the other therapies and the meds and everything else, that I'm surprised of, like my ability that maybe something adverse or unwanted happens and I will react, but I can reframe it in a period of time that I'm like, how did I do that? I've asked my brother, I'm like, I don't understand. And he said, David, I think what ECT has done is taken the blockage of depression and moved it away and allowed you to have access to all these other tools and things that you've been taught over these last 10 plus years. Now you have more direct and immediate access to those. And I'm like, oh, wow. Okay, that makes sense. So I didn't, sir, this was not a path. I thought I'd take care of animals for the rest of my life. And all I'm trying to do now, I want to honor the army that I so love. And I want to just let people know it's possible to be better. I'm not saying it's easy. It's hard. But I'm saying it's worth it. I'm saying it's doable. And I'm saying we can help each other in ways that are so simple. They can literally, we're all lifesavers. And I'll do a quote, sir, that really puts it into the best perspective. Dr. Drew Ramsey is a psychiatrist, and he says this: someone you see today is thinking about killing themselves. Your smile, your question, your love could save them. Trust me, they told me it did.
Wow. You know, if you're struggling, you know, with this, there are other things that you can go through that can help individuals, and all individuals, of course, are different, you know, and definitely seek the advice of your physician as they kind of guide you through the process. But just like you are, I think, you know, be open to different methods that can help get you kind of through this process. I know we focus a lot on from the officer's perspective, the person that actually connected with you. What advice would you give someone who is struggling right now with suicidal thoughts?
And thank you for asking the question, sir. The first thing I would say is the great acronym of HOPE is hold on, pain ends. And I'm not saying that from a Pollyanna standpoint. Please believe me, brother or sister who's listening. I am not saying that. What I'm saying is in the midst of our terrible pain, in which the monster has us believe that it will never end, I get that belief. I get it. What I'm saying is from the reality, the empirical side, is that it can end. I'm not saying it's easy. So that. And the next thing that I would ask you to please do is to find that person in your life, and hopefully you have them, to share how you feel, but set it up before you do. And here's what I would suggest is you find that person. Let's say for me, it'd be Colonel Thomas. I'd say, hey, sir, I'm suffering right now. And it would be really helpful for me to share something with you. But if I could, I'm not looking for advice. I'm just looking for someone to hear me. Could I please just share this with you? And I think if you set it up 99.999% of the time in that way, and this is what was taught to me, the Colonel Thomases of the world, they're just going to listen to do. And then if you are the Colonel Thomas, when you hear it, because people ask me all the time, sir, it's like, well, what can I do to support somebody who's suffering? And the answer is ask them. And they'll say, what do you mean? You just say, ask this question. What can I do to help you feel most supported? And you're going to be surprised at what people say. I have a friend of mine recently who reached out to me, and I said, what can I do to help you feel supported? And he said, just stay in touch. And so over the course of a couple of months, I just every day, like my brother taught me, sent him a text. And I made sure to say, I love you so incredibly much. And the other day, you know what he texted me back? He said, hey, I've turned a corner. And I wanted to thank you for reminding me who I am. And sir, all I did was just do what my brother does. But the power of that. Thank you for reminding me who I am. Like, we can do that, because that's the creation. The hope requires action and engagement, and people don't kill themselves when they're hopeful. So then if we can create it and we can connect, that means we can just be shooting hope out everywhere.
You know, it's interesting too. You talk about hope, but also I think for someone to be courageous enough to ask somebody for help, I think it also has to be some sort of trust there as well. And I think that's what is important when we deal with this in the military is, you know, do you have anyone in your unit, your commander, your first sergeant, your sergeant major, your battle buddy, you know, who is that person in your organization or even outside of your military organization that you can trust with sharing some of your most deep pain that you're going through? And the expectation would be within the military, you've got a cadre of people around you that you can talk to, and they'll respond in a way that can give you the help you need. But I think you're right. I think it's the hope, it's being able to trust someone and having the courage at the time to ask that important question so that someone can give you the help that you need. And just like you said, that hopefully with that engagement and positive experience, that time, you know, an issue will pass. As we reach the end of the show, what is one last thing that you want people to know?
I think, sir, I'm going to go back and repeat Dr. Ramsey's quote. You know, what Dr. Ramsey says, someone you see today is thinking about killing themselves. So just, you know, when we go out, like we and we're not going to know that the vast majority of the time, but we can guarantee that's going to happen. Here's a man who has sat with all these suicidal people. Mm-hmm. He knows it. So that someone you see today is thinking about killing themselves. Our smile, our question, mm-hmm. our love could save them. Trust me, they told me it did. Let's wow. just do that everywhere we go. Every place we go, let's smile more. Let's ask what questions, inviting people to share more, and let's let people know how we feel about them. You know, and if it's by way of text, I can tell you from my personal experience on the receiving and the sending, it changes lives.
Also, just thinking about the fact that you don't know what people are going through at any particular time of the day. So just don't assume that everything is going right for everyone that you see. Make the assumption, just like you said with the quote, you know, that someone is having a hard time. They may be thinking, you know, have suicidal thoughts, or they're going through a deep, dark time in their life. Consider that when you're addressing people and talking with them, and that hopefully you're providing, just like you said, providing that hope that they need, and you're a trusted individual that they can talk to so that you can change kind of what they're going through and help provide the assistance they need at that critical time.
Absolutely, sir. Perfectly said.
Well, David, thank you again for taking the time today to share your story with us and our listeners. Suicide prevention is such an important topic, and teaching people that talking about it and asking for help is so critical, especially for our military and veteran families. Every one of us needs to help break the silence and end the perceived stigma that surrounds the topic of suicide and mental health, especially in the military and veteran communities. We all need to work to banish the idea that asking for help is wrong. Asking for help is one of the bravest things we can do. We all need to understand that each of us has a role to play in preventing suicide. Simple actions like staying connected, checking in with people, or just listening can make all of the difference. Every suicide is one too many. Whether you or someone you know needs help, there are many resources out there. No one should face their problems alone. Visit 988lifeline.org. Visit www.veteranscrisisline.net or www.va.gov/reach to find resources, or call 988 and press 1, text 838-255, or chat online with www.veteranscrisisline.net if you or someone you know needs help now. We appreciate you all tuning in today. Please follow or subscribe to the Soldier for Life podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. I'm Colonel Jared Thomas, and I look forward to being with you again on our next episode. Once a soldier, always a soldier, a soldier for life.